Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. A few weeks ago, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts introduced a congressional resolution, which I'm sure you've all heard about by now, called the Green New Deal. The proposal, which was met with both great fanfare and aggressive criticism, calls on the federal government to wean the U.S. from fossil fuels, curb planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions across the economy, and guarantee new high-paying jobs in clean energy industries. Today, we're going to learn more about what the proposal entails exactly and what it means for our food system. Joining me to discuss is Christopher D. Cook, an award-winning journalist who writes for Harper's, The Atlantic, Mother Jones, The Economist, and many others. He's also the author of Diet for a Dead Planet, Big Business, and the Coming Food Crisis. More recently, he's written about the Green New Deal in The Nation and for Civil Eats, and I'm so pleased it's brought him to the show today. Christopher, welcome.
Hi, Jenna. Nice to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Okay, so before we get into the discussion about the Green New Deal, I want to talk about your background. You've been writing about food system issues for a very long time. You know, I think that your book was like one of the first, at least in my opinion, kind of big books to like bring a lot of these food system issues to our kind of public consciousness. So can you tell me what drew you to write about the challenges in our food system in the first place?
Yeah, thank you. It all started for me, I mean, I've been interested in a lot of labor issues around the food system for quite some time, especially farm workers, something I even did some reporting on in college and remained interested in. And but this sort of stemmed from some reporting I was doing in the 1990s, way back then, about welfare reform, or deform, as many of us called it, in which there were a lot of schemes to privatize welfare benefits and basically push recipients into some of the most brutal work in America that nobody else wanted to do. And one of those main sectors was the chicken industry, chicken and meat packing. And so I became sort of gruesomely acquainted with more of the details of how our meat is made, our meat and chicken, and the kind of struggles that workers, welfare recipients, and other workers, migrant, immigrant workers, go through in producing our food supply. And through reporting on that, visited farm country more and just got more and more deeply fascinated by the sort of confluence of all these crises, forms of exploitation that were basically being driven by large corporate agriculture and the corporate food industry. And so, you know, what we saw was, especially in the 1990s and still today, was large corporations taking over more and more of the food system, just about every single part of it, from meat production to food processing to, you know, controlling just about every major commodity group that you can think of, or food group you can think of. And in the, while they were controlling that, they were also controlling the terms of labor and land use and impacts on the environment and the fate of farmers. And so basically we saw thousands of farmers going out of business, foreclosing their farms due to poverty and debt and being priced out of the market, and just massive water and air pollution from the meat industry as well as from pesticide-fueled agriculture. And the mainstay of our food supply is still what many people call industrial agriculture, which is, mm-hmm. you know, a large-scale monocrops or single crop, one or two crop production of commodities like corn and wheat and soy and other commodities that are used for processed foods, basically, or they're used primarily for feed for livestock, therefore the meat industry, and increasingly as a biofuel.
Right. So this issues were what originally drew you to write this this book. And so what was the goal that you were hoping to accomplish in writing the book?
Yeah.
Like drawing awareness or
change everything.
Yeah.
you know, but of course that doesn't happen.
Well, not all at once, but you know,
it starts. No, it doesn't. But you hope that you're making a contribution that supports an idea for change. I don't believe in just, you know, writing a collection of facts and just leaving it at that. You know, but I think it all has to be fact driven and evidence based as well. Of course, mm-hmm. As a journalist. You know, one of the original great works was Francis Merleau-Ponty's Diet for a Small Planet in the early 70s, and obviously my title references that, and it's essentially saying, you know, this is how we're not living the way we need to live, and that we're not eating and growing food, producing food the way we need to survive,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is regarding the climate, as we'll talk about, as we can talk about an environment beyond climate, as well as just our, you know, our farm sector, rural communities around this country, workers, you know, the whole, you know, my book goes into this and other articles talk about this, you know, just the whole sort of, you know, total devastation that's created by the food industry. And you think of food as something that's supposed to be nourishing and nurturing and supposed to feed us and sustain us, and the creation of food now in this industrial system has become something that is profoundly unsustainable and profoundly harmful for workers, farmers, consumers, and the environment as a whole.
Has anything changed, you know, drastically since you first published this book? I mean, certainly the movement, the quote movement mm-hmm. itself has gained a lot of steam compared with like the mid-2000s, right? So are there a few key mm-hmm. issues that you have noticed that continue to get better mm-hmm. and those that continue to get worse?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I think that it's been something where many of us have been writing and many more have been active on different fronts, national, local, state, whether it's legislative or actually in the soil, and creating some wonderful changes. You know, whether it's urban agriculture has been this really blossoming movement around the country that is taking a lot of vacant lands and unused and underutilized lands and rebuilding the soil and making it something where we can actually grow food, and sometimes even, you know, doing that in a way that gives folks in poor neighborhoods and communities of color, giving people jobs or giving people an opportunity to work in the land and learn how to work with the land and revitalize, you know, certain crops and feed their community. So there's some great hope in that respect, as well as, you know, organic food production as a whole has been booming, mm-hmm. you know, in recent decades. And, you know, overall, that's absolutely a good, important thing for both human health and for the environment to get those pesticides out of there. But, mm-hmm. you know, as we've seen with everything else in the food sector and in our economy, it's become taken over more and more by large-scale industrial interests and corporate interests. And so it's still better to have large-scale organic than large-scale pesticide food production, but you still have a problem where more and more of the land and production is controlled by a few companies, and you know, and that can drive things like single crop production, which is not good for the soil, mm-hmm. For instance, you know, and which actually requires more water, for instance. You know, the soil doesn't replenish itself, doesn't hold the water as well. So there's a lot of different aspects of that that are not helpful. You know, and we've seen, you know, Walmart is now, I think, the single biggest purveyor of organic foods. And again, you know, you want to see...
Yeah, isn't that a
organic
good...
food. It is, well, you know, I mean, I don't know that there's really much of anything good that's connected to Walmart. But I do think that what you do want is organic food to become accessible and affordable
right.
to the general population and to everybody. That is an absolute... necessity. And, you know, sadly, in a way, Walmart is probably, you know, because of their pricing systems, they can do better at that than some other places. What I would argue, and we can go into this more, and I think it's part of actually the Green New Deal, as I and others see it, you know, is that we need various public investments and supports to expand smaller scale and medium scale organic farming mm-hmm. in a way that feeds local and regional markets and that enables farmers to deal with, you know, whether it's selling more in farmers markets or to local and regional stores that are not, you know, the problem with Walmart is, A, they exploit their workers, many of whom rely on food stamps, you know, famously, but it's still true today, you know, to get their food because mm-hmm. they're impoverished. And they exploit small businesses and farmers because they have all the negotiating power and yeah. leverage.
Okay, so what about, I mean, are there any examples, before we switch to talk about the Green New Deal, I mean, I feel like there are examples of corporations really trying to put forward more meaningful sustainability goals and kind of mm-hmm. doing more progressive work in sure. the service of creating a better food system. Like, are there any examples out there of companies you think are doing good things right now?
Yeah, I think that there are companies that are making better, more commitments, and mm-hmm. there's been pressure from even globally on, yeah. on massive food corporations and their supply chains to make sure that, you know, they're treating workers on the land and farmers better. And mm-hmm. you know, we have seen some good commitments. You know, what's not clear yet is whether those commitments are really being delivered on. And, you know, I think that aspect remains to be seen. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't want to sort of call out an individual company and give them undue praise. But, you know, I think it's true that, you know, some big corporations and companies, due to this public education and pressure, are seeing that there are chunks of the market that really are growing where there's this really significant concern about whether it's humane treatment of animals to, you know, less pressure but some pressure on humane treatment of workers
mm-hmm.
And making sure that the food is either healthier or less harmful to our bodies. And, you know, so there are those bits of progress happening. You know, I would argue that, you know, I'm all for any form of progress that we can get.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I am one who, having studied the food system for many years, I would have a concern with anybody seeing that as the solution. You know, the problem is, you know, there is an aspect in which these corporations still have phenomenal buying power and negotiating power in the marketplace with workers and with farmers and small businesses and producers who are on the ground level doing, you know, making the food.
Yeah.
And when you have that negotiating power, you're demanding maximum profit, and the profit has to come out of somewhere. and it almost invariably comes out of the pockets of farmers and workers.
Yeah, that's definitely true. All right. Well, how did you come to write about the Green New Deal specifically? Because I don't think that there's really not a lot to write about right now. I mean, we have some ideas, but you're like one of the first, especially with regard to the food system, talking about this proposal. So, what kind of drew you to it and inspired you to start covering it?
Yeah, it was something that, you know, I was thinking actually about stories that I wanted to write in the new year or late last year as well about sort of the newly Democratic Congress and a couple of different ideas of things that there was an opportunity to really push a new agenda and not only push Republicans, but frankly push many of the Democrats as well. And so, you know, one article I wrote was about the People's Budget and the Progressive Caucus in Congress, which is the largest caucus or one of the largest caucuses in Congress. And that sort of perennial effort to try to readjust priorities, domestic priorities in spending and in programs and make them more economically just and environmentally responsible as well. And one of the ideas that I thought about, I mean, not that I came up with it, you know, it's been around for about a decade or more, was the idea that, you know, the new Congress ought to be looking at something like the Green New Deal. You know, I think there were murmurings of this and interest, you know, it was kind of a funny thing where I happened to pitch my editor at The Nation, and just a few days after I'd pitched them and they'd said, yes, go ahead, there were suddenly headlines about the Green New Deal because Sunrise Movement and Ocasio-Cortez were protesting inside the halls of Congress and in Nancy Pelosi's office and in other places, really sort of raising up this issue.
Yeah.
In the headlines. They really did it. You know, I mean, it's, you know, again, the idea, you know, you have to give some credit to the Green Party and to other folks who have been talking about this idea for many years.
Right, because it's not new. It's not a new idea, right? You said it's been kind of percolating.
It's been percolating, and people have been talking about it. You know, the term green jobs has been around for a while. Green New Deal is a larger concept, you know, that references obviously the original New Deal from the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Great Depression, and the idea being both in content but also in scope and boldness, this idea that you'd really be taking on a quite grand project, not grandiose, but grand, you know, in the sense that to say, you know, this is not just sort of one piece of legislation or a little bit of tweaking, or and it's not just a few green jobs over here or over there. It's really about addressing some of the fundamentals in our economy.
Right.
And so some people are saying it's going way too far, and others are thinking it's not going far enough. And
yeah,
you know, yeah, that's politics.
That is politics. Do you want to tell us just briefly what the Sunrise Movement is, so we can help set the stage here?
Yeah, so you know, I didn't know about them until this, and they haven't been around that long as a movement. And also, the folks who are at the sort of focal point of it or leading it or haven't been around that long, frankly. They're which is part of the, you know, which is to say that they're young folks, and they are growing up amidst this looming cloud of, it's not even looming, it's a real cloud of climate crisis. You know, and it kind of reminds me of when I was growing up in the 80s and, you know, so much of the talk was around nuclear weapons, nuclear war, and even nuclear power as being just this huge presence that had the distinct possibility of destroying all of us. And this is something where it's actually happening, and it's not something where we're just, you know, waiting to see if somebody pushes a button or not. You know, it's actually happening every day because of some of the fundamentals in our economy, the global economy, not just the U.S. economy, but the U.S. is one of the chief engines of climate change, unfortunately. But so, you know, Sunrise Movement are folks anywhere from, say, early teens to late 20s, roughly, who have been out there really organizing and making noise and protesting in different congressional offices and the halls of Congress. And, you know, you have to give them some credit for for really raising up, you know, the issue in the public eye, you know, and so I think that, you know, the what's interesting is that you see also a lot of leadership from the younger members of the new Congress as well. And so there is this way in which as much as many of us middle-aged and older folks definitely are there and we get it, there's a way in which the newer generations, I think, are just, they're steeped in this. They're, you know, if they're aware and they're caring and they're focused, they're seeing, excuse me, that they're steeped in this reality.
Yeah. They're angry because, like, nothing has really been done on this in ever.
Right. I mean, it's a huge, I mean, this is the issue, the challenge is that it is a massive effort. And, you know, which is why, you know, you might see something as exciting and bold as the Green New Deal resolution being attacked on both ends, you know, because it threatens, in many ways, it threatens the interests of
the establishment.
The fossil fuel industry, Democrats and Republicans, many of whom get fossil fuel money. And I think that has something to do with some of the opposition, even from the Democratic side, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're gonna talk a little bit more about the opposition in just a second. But before we go too far, like, what is in its most basic form? This is a This is a resolution. So, is this binding? Like, will this become law if it's voted on? Can you just tell us about like what it is? what this thing is?
absolutely. And folks, you know, I encourage folks to look it up more in more detail. Online, and you can go to my article at Civil Eats has a link to it, and you can also check it out through Ocasio-Cortez's website, I believe. But so it's a resolution that is being put forth in the House and in the Senate, as you mentioned earlier, and it's not, as far as I know, it's not binding, and it's not legislation. And so I think that, you know, my sense is that when the first salvo came up in the new Congress in the early part of the new year, and it was shot down fairly quickly by Speaker Pelosi and others and the House leadership standing where. The reason, you know, that I'm saying this is because this is kind of how this thing came about as a resolution, you know, that there was a try for a larger Green New Deal legislation and a committee to take this on. And the underlying goal seems to be to create legislation that's signature ready, so to speak, by 2020. By the time, if you got a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, you might have the opportunity with legislation that's ready to go.
Okay.
And so this resolution is has some concrete goals, such as, again, you know, full carbon.
Well, did
carbon
the committee? Neutrality. So the committee didn't happen. That was shot down.
Right.
You said in the winter or like before the new year.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So there was a push almost right away from Ocasio-Cortez and a couple others to create this Green New Deal committee.
Okay.
Which would be a place where this legislation could be created over a 2-year period.
Okay.
I don't think anybody expected to create it overnight.
Right.
And I think that their strategy or idea was, you know, we need a committee so that we can really focus on this as a whole and create that legislation. So that was shot down by the Democratic leadership. And instead, they recreated a climate global warming committee, an energy committee that Pelosi had launched in 2007 that has no legislative authority and no subpoena powers. And so there's been this
which means they couldn't create. Does that, sorry to keep interrupting you, I just want to make sure
I'm jumping around.
No, I just want to make sure I'm getting all the, you know, all my ducks
so
in
what
row.
It,
but
what it means is they can't, so the climate committee can't create its own legislation and it can't require, say, Exxon or other, let's just say, other corporate executives to come testify about their emissions in some form.
Got it. All right, so it's toothless. So what is the purpose?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it does, you know, perhaps it can be a place where some of the discussion can happen in hearings. And, you know, so I'm not going to say it's toothless, but it's not nearly what folks had been pushing for. And frankly, what's, I would say, is utterly necessary. You know, and so even though I'm a journalist and I look at all this, you know, it is, frankly, kind of maddening mm-hmm. when you see what the science says, you know, see what the internationally accepted science says about us having between 12 and 15 years to basically reverse, well, not even reverse, but try to avoid mitigate. Some of the worst impacts yeah. of climate change.
So that didn't happen. So then what? So then AOC and Markey were just like, we're going to do it ourselves? Or how did the proposal right. come about then?
Yeah, so I don't know their full strategy, but I sense that, you know, from looking at this, that they must have recognized that we're not going to, you know, they're not going to get full legislation passed. And I'm assuming that this is a precursor to legislation and maybe a way to sort of see where people are at, to see what could pass muster. So this is my interpretation, not mm-hmm. necessarily, and that, you know, one would hope that following this would be actual legislation. And Senator Merkley from Oregon has been working on some related legislation around the Green New Deal as well. And so there's some action on various fronts to, I think, push this in different ways and see where they can get the support. You know, and so again, that's why you get the situation where, you know, some people feel like it's a little general in some of the terms that it talks about, but, you know, some of the goals are very clear, you know, again, like carbon neutrality by 2030, getting to full renewable energy and decarbonization, as they call it, you know, basically eliminating carbon monoxide production from the U.S. economy, mm-hmm. Which would take a huge, huge push, but it's also utterly essential.
Okay. So, yeah. So what are, so is it 2030 or 2050?
Well, my understanding was 2030. I think that there's going to be this constant negotiation and battling over, what percentage can be reduced and by when. And of course those calculations, will have a lot to do with, how far people are willing to go. Frankly, in using legislation in the public sector to spur more renewable energy production, to expand the electric grid, mm-hmm. And expand solar and wind and tidal energy, and to really dramatically reduce and downscale carbon emissions and therefore, you know, and greenhouse gases. And so therefore what that means is really reducing everything from, you know, huge power plants in the power sector and the energy grid and getting away from that and coal-fired plants, and certainly the use of oil and gas, which is part of our national economic infrastructure right now, you mm-hmm. know, even just whether it's semi-trucks or rail or other forms of shipping and transit, obviously jet fuel being in the mix as well, for both personal, you know, human travel as well as yeah. for commerce.
I think that 2050 was the for the entire world, their goal, like right. worldwide, and then for the U.S. yeah. right, it's 2030. So just wanted to make sure that was that yeah, point of clarification exactly. on my end. Very fairly broad, wide-reaching, and there is a big part, you know, it's pretty, I don't know if it's, like, optimistic, but the number of new jobs that would be created through this, like, there is this thought in this country, I think, that switching to renewables is going to put all these people out of work, but isn't mm-hmm. it kind of the reverse? Aren't there, like, isn't it one of the biggest yeah. growing sector, like, job sectors that we have right now is, like, clean energy jobs?
Absolutely. I mean, this is really, you know, one of the worst red herrings that's put out by some of the fossil fuel industry interests and some of their friends. Excuse me. I mean, there's research on this, and I have this in my article in The Nation if people want to look it up as well. It's called Can the Blue Wave Deliver a Green New Deal? It's a little old, but it's still got some of this information in it about, the jobs comparison between, say, coal production and other fossil fuel production and renewable, and it's just not even close. I mean, it's just so dramatically, these renewable energy sectors, electric grid sectors, are creating way more jobs. Green economy is creating way more jobs. Mm-hmm. And like anything else, they run the gamut, you know, from perhaps lower wage service oriented positions to whether it's, you know, some form of design or mechanical work, or implementation or construction, or, you know, there's all these different other aspects that, can really involve, higher wage, unionized, potentially, hopefully unionized jobs, all across the country. And, you know, what's interesting to me as well when I was researching this earlier is that, you know, many of the big fossil fuel states are also places that are struggling economically. So they're producing the fossil fuels. They're producing also, therefore, disproportionate levels of emission of greenhouse gas emissions through the production and transport of the fossil fuels. And then they're struggling economically with whether it's poverty or low wages and underemployment. So, you know, whether it's West Virginia or Wyoming or New Mexico, other places, parts of Texas. So there's huge, you know, in portions of these states, you know, regions where that are even especially dependent on this. So this is, you know, it is what we make it. You know, I think it's something where, you know, the possibilities are quite huge if politicians and the government and, of course, the general public are willing to make this happen, you know, to use the public interest and the public investment money as a spur to create these jobs.
Well, you know, Andrew Wheeler is now officially the head of the EPA, so I think we got it. Yeah. I think we're all good. I think we're a lot of movement on this front.
Oh, goodness, yeah. I know. I mean, that's the sad, frustrating thing. But I think on the other side, you know, what is hopeful is the movement, both on the streets, as well as in some parts of Congress, and also in states and localities. You know, let's not forget that it doesn't all happen in Congress. That hugely matters. But there's a lot of action going on state levels as well and local levels to, you know, everything from, you know, speaking of food, for instance, it's like trying to get school districts and other municipal agencies to dramatically reduce meat consumption as just one area, for instance. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies on this that show that, you know, school districts, for instance, can reduce meat consumption and the kids are still, you know, enjoying lunch and just as healthy, if not healthier, and money can be saved, water can be saved, and it reduces carbon emissions.
Right.
So there are things like that that, on a larger scale, actually make a huge dent. You know, and when we're talking about food, it's a really underestimated aspect of the larger economy and of both the cause as well as potential solution to climate change.
Yes, we should probably talk about the food system's relationship to, or, you know, place in this Green New Deal. But, so I also want to play a quick game of true or false with you before we get into there. And you know what? We're going to take a quick break. That is what we need to do. We need to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to play a fun game of true or false about what is in the Green New Deal and talk more about what it means for our food system specifically. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Andrew Friedman, and I'm the host of Andrew Talks to Chefs here on HRN. Every week, I interview a diverse cross-section of the best and biggest names in professional cooking. Give a listen and get to know all about the inner lives of chefs. You can find Andrew Talks to Chefs wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm talking with Christopher D. Cook about the Green New Deal. Okay, before we went to break, I said we're going to play True or False, a little fun game, and now we're going to get into it. All right, you ready?
All right. Okay.
Okay. Will the Green New Deal take away our, and I quote, airplane rights?
Airplane rights?
Yes, says President Trump.
Well, first of all, we don't have airplane rights. There's
all
no
right.
such thing. But if you want,
so I guess it's a no.
I guess no. You
okay,
know.
Cool.
I'll just say maybe it should overall, but not on an individual level.
I don't know, man. My family lives across the country, so I really need to fly.
I'll get a bunch of tirades over that one. But
all right, next one. Will the Green New Deal confiscate our cars and require Americans to ride around on high-speed light rail, supposedly maybe powered by unicorn tears, as suggested by my favorite, Senator Tom Cotton? True or false?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Did we even dignify this? No.
I don't know.
Absolutely
like,
not.
Unicorn tears are a thing, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. No confiscation is going to be proposed, and even if it were, it wouldn't happen.
All right, here's the really important one that certainly affects me on an everyday basis from Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Which, okay, ready? Will ice cream, cheeseburgers, and milkshakes be a thing of the past under the Green New Deal because livestock will be banned? It's like a big problem for me because I really love dairy. So is that going to happen?
Yeah. So you and others can apply for waivers and exemptions to make sure you still get your...
No.
I mean, if I could, you know, I think that, you know, that what's interesting... do you have one more or can I?
No, that's it. All three. Yeah, those are,
okay.
I'm sure
so,
there were more, but those are like right. the highlights that I really clung to from Twitter.
No, they're amazing. And you know, but I think what's fascinating about some of these scare tactics is that A, they're not going to happen. Even if some of the advocates wanted it to happen.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the proposal often is for less of some of this or a lot of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
not none of it. And nobody's proposing that the big bad government, so to speak, would have any power to take away any of this stuff. So, you know, I think that the irony of all this is that we do need to dramatically reduce meat and dairy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And we do need to dramatically reduce our jet travel until we have some other more sustainable way of doing it. It doesn't mean none, and it doesn't mean that the government is taking it away from anybody. But this is also kind of, you know, I would say really an infantilization of the voters and of the general public, and it's so insulting on so many levels because it assumes and presumes that this is all anybody cares about and that we're not also, like, grown adults and young folks who are often more adult than many of the adults in the room, who recognize that there are more important things. I mean, this is like on the micro level that they're kind of playing the game at. It's like when we all grow up, we learn that there are things that are more important than other things and that some things take precedent.
It is baffling to me, though, and we talked a little bit about you know, the fact that there is kind of opposition for the Green New Deal, even in the Democratic Party. But, you know, you see these statistics from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, which they do a lot of surveying. And they, you know, one of their recent surveys says 71% of Americans think global warming is happening. And 47% say they're very or extremely sure. And 50% of them say that they believe there'll be personally harmed by global warming. So mm-hmm. I just don't understand where the disconnect is among anyone in terms of
I mean, right. No, I mean, I think this is, you know, on one level, you know, maybe there's some human natural denial going on, but, you know, not to psychologize it. I mean, on the larger level, there are profound, massive industrial, corporate interests, economic interests that are lined up behind the status quo, the economic status quo. And, you know, I don't think anybody is proposing to just immediately pull the rug out from under anyone. You know, I think that what's exciting to me, and again, going back to why I wanted to write about this, is I'm interested in proactive, forward-looking ideas that are not just responding and saying no. You know, I mean, this is part of the thing that Democrats, progressives, others, you know, it's easy to say no to certain glaringly, you know, horrible things that are happening in Washington and elsewhere. But, you know, we have to say yes to something. And it's like, if we're going to create a future that has any sort of livability to it for human beings and for many species out there, frankly, the planet, as many point out, will be fine. Mm-hmm. But there are humans and many species who will be either eradicated or woefully just, you know, in widespread, even worse misery. And the disconnect, I think, is a mixture of, you know, again, these huge interests behind the status quo. And in some cases, the larger and more urgently necessary the change is, the greater that disconnect might be, you know, because it's huge.
Change is scary, and people don't want to give up stuff.
Right. And, you know,
like,
I think also,
like me with dairy.
Right. Well, there's that fear, you know. I think there's also, there's just the climate denialism that's created by the fossil fuel industry and the Republican Party has mm-hmm. been, you know, and almost everybody in the Republican Party is some form of climate denialist, and it's just, it's so profoundly irresponsible and really criminal in the sense that we have something that is objectively happening, that is happening to the planet, and that really knows no bounds. You know, there are people in the world feeling it more immediately than others, and I think that's the other aspect, is that, you know, what people call frontline communities globally and in the U.S. that tend to be poorer folks who are seeing the impacts much more dramatically. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that, for instance, farmers all around the U.S. are feeling the effects of climate change. Hugely, and they're losing tons of money. And, you know, we're paying $300 billion a year or more for the impacts of climate change every year. So it's like we're paying already.
$300 billion, wow.
The price tag is huge because of all the different crises and emergencies and that happen that are related to climate change. And so, you know, this idea of a Green New Deal is about spending the money proactively and preventively, and also to, you know, there's a lot of forms of adaptation that have to take place, you know, and just like within the food sector, which is a huge area where, again, everybody from farmers to food corporations, they're aware of this problem. They even talk about it in their government filings. The big public corporations talk about this as a risk factor, climate change. So they're aware of it. Mm-hmm. They're ahead of the Republicans and some others in government around this. We really need to, you know, have a massive shift from the kinds of, you know, we pay, for instance, $13 to $15 billion a year in subsidies and crop insurance that go almost entirely to the large-scale sort of single crop type of industrial production that I talked about before, mm-hmm. That is pesticide-fueled, that is creating ingredients for the fuel and meat industries primarily. And so we absolutely have to shift those investments. The same farmers or other farmers in those regions can get that money and create or shift to organic production and shift to local and regional market production. And you can also create more jobs for farmers and related job sectors within rural economies that can really boost rural America by helping to shift farmers in this way that is not just changing what they farm, but encouraging soil practices that benefit the environment, benefit their crops. Expanding markets for organic and local foods, not because it sounds nice, but because it's fundamentally better for farmers and for the environment.
So how would all this happen in the Green New Deal? Like what that is currently kind of in the proposal, the broad strokes, of course, what would that mean for our food system? What would it encourage?
Right. So in the current resolution, there's not much, to be honest. There's a nod to some of these larger principles. There's a few phrases, basically, in a very short section. I think there's a lot of folks pushing in different ways, farming groups, agriculture groups, and environmental groups around the country, and food workers and farm workers who are pushing for things to be in the Green New Deal that would include things like more money for research and market expansion and technical support for people to shift to organic food. So like a lot of farmers would like to make that shift. They can see that they might make more money, better money. They can see that it might be better for their health and their local environment. They don't have the ability right now to do that. They don't have the resources always to make that shift. Often they're locked into these contracts with the Monsantos and others of the world, requiring them to do GMO production and use associated pesticides and chemical fertilizers. And farmers are often in this trap where, so this isn't like Washington telling farmers, like this is the classic Republican line would be, Washington's telling farmers what to produce. And it's such another one of these red herrings, because it's actually expanding opportunities and enabling farmers to make the shift that so many of them want to make, but they can't make it. So you'd invest, and you'd take some of that money that goes into these huge corporate subsidies and crop insurance programs, and you'd move it into more money for smaller scale and medium scale organic production and market expansion in local and regional areas.
And organic specifically, you think that, because I'm a little bit on the fence about whether or not it needs to be USDA designated organic.
Right. There's a lot of debate about that, and I'm using organic as a larger term because So regenerative agriculture.
Sustainable.
Is a movement that sustainable agriculture.
Okay.
So a lot of this is about, less tillage of the soil.
Right.
Not necessarily no-till, but less till of the soil.
Okay.
More crop rotation, no pesticides and chemical fertilizers. Agroecology is this whole larger set of principles and practices that I really encourage folks to look up on their own, since we don't have a whole lot more time, but there's a great set of principles around caring for the soil. I mean, it all starts with the soil and also revitalizing heirloom seeds and biodiversity, as being this other key thing that our food system is destroying. And it's not because of farmers, it's because of this larger set of economic incentives from the market and from government policy. So this will really, we could drive this in another direction that could also encourage farmers to protect pollinators, expand pollinator habitats surrounding farmlands. And if you give farmers the incentives to do it, they'll do it.
Right. Yeah. Yes, yeah. That is 100% sure.
Absolutely. Let's not restrict it to USDA organic. That's a very good point, I think, that you make, that, there are a lot of debates about that. And, but I think that it is a set of practices that people talk about that are critically important for soil, that create healthier food, that create far, really, no pollution, so to speak, far less pollution, radically reduces emissions, and also create soil that can store carbon. The other thing we have to do is store, sequester, as they say, so much of the carbon in our environment. That's a huge goal of the Green New Deal and what we need to do. And soil, rebuilding soil across America, nobody can do that better than farmers. And if they're given the right set of incentives to do it, they'll do it.
And you think that it's very important, especially for the food industry, ag industry, to become a bigger part of the Green New Deal, because you write that food and ag is responsible for 9% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. So you think this is like a bigger call to action for this industry?
sorry. Yeah, absolutely. And 9% is really
on the low end.
I use that because it's the only thing that the EPA makes available publicly that's official. Globally, it's 30%. And so likely in the U.S., it must be close to that or 20 to 30. You know, so let's, you know, put that in perspective. But, yeah, it's a huge call for this. And it's a recognition for those even working on the Green New Deal to even just recognize the centrality of food production. Because, again, it is globally 30%. It's the largest single economic sector in terms of causes of climate change and greenhouse gases is the food sector. Food and agriculture sector, the top one.
The top
across the globe.
Sorry, you said the top cause of?
The top cause is food and agriculture production and all the different things associated with that. Deforestation, land removal, you know, all kinds of things like that. So this is a call to action within the U.S., both in the Green New Deal and beyond, really, to move in a completely different direction, you know, and it's, again, what the science calls on us to do. And, you know, whether it's, you know, you're looking at climate change or you're looking at water pollution in America, you know, industrial agriculture is the top polluter of waterways across America. So, you know, coming from pesticides and chemical fertilizers, as well as from large scale factory farms, concentrated animal productions. So it's not about saying no meat, no dairy, you know, that we can have debates about all of that, but it is about saying less. And far better.
Yeah.
And I think there's a good argument for making it, you know, I'm not saying, you know, eliminate all of it, but I think that, you know, the point is we need to radically reduce.
Yeah, that's for sure.
For so many reasons. And give these farmers, you know, the last thing I'll mention here is that, you know, originally in the American economy, and my book goes into a lot more detail about this, farmers were really into diverse production. They had animal production and crop production, primarily for local and regional markets. And we've moved so far away from that that we really need to move back in that direction and encourage farmers to do that. And part of that is to also give farmers a fair price. So it's not just the subsidy piece. It's also something a lot of people are talking about now is this old concept that goes back to the original New Deal, this idea of parity pricing, a fair price minimum wage for farmers. And that will enable them to produce diverse food supplies for local and regional economies and not overproduce, you know, not just mass produce one product because that's how they survive. That's a terrible way for anybody to survive.
Yeah. Yes. Quickly, we have to wrap up in like 60 seconds, but next steps for the proposal. I read that Mitch McConnell is like no words. He's calling for a vote. Like he wants to bring the if it's not a piece of legislation, can you just give me a little like civics lesson?
Yeah. Here? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of politics going on there. I think there's a push for a delay in the vote.
And, but what would they vote on if it's, like, totally non-binding?
Well, it would be on the resolution. I believe it would be on Ed Markey's resolution. And I'm sure what they're doing is they know that the Republican majority will kill it, and they'd like to try to, like, kill this movement as quickly
Nip
as they
it in
could,
the bed. Yeah.
I guess. It's going to keep going in the House. I mean, I think everybody from Ocasio-Cortez to others understands that right now this is about propagating the ideas and the policies and moving it through the House and educating the American public and laying the groundwork to make this possible in 2020. Everybody knows it's not going to happen right now. But if you don't do this work now, then you're starting from scratch in 2020. And again, 12 to 15 years, that's the science. That's not somebody's opinion.
Yeah.
We can't afford delay from either party, including the Democratic Party, from Feinstein to Pelosi to others who have really thrown some wrenches in this movement. We really need to see people wake up and see the reality, the scientific reality, and the need for pretty huge, urgent change.
Yeah. All right. I'm assuming you're going to continue covering this topic?
As much as possible, writing about it in different ways. Yeah. Playing whatever role I can play as a journalist and supporter. Yeah.
Where can we find a copy of your book, and where can we go to continue to follow your work?
Yeah, thank you. So again, it's called Diet for a Dead Planet, and it's been around since around 2006 in paperback, but it's still, I would say, highly relevant.
Very relevant, so, yes.
Bookstores online, I always encourage local bookstores or Powell's Books online is another good place you can get it. And then articles, you know, this piece I wrote in The Nation, Can the Blue Wave Deliver a Green New Deal? And then article in Civil Eats recently about the food and farming aspects of the Green New Deal is another one that I might point folks to and read more there, hopefully.
Right. And your website is your personal website?
Thank you. Yeah, so my website is ChristopherDCook.com, www.ChristopherDCook.com. Many more of my articles there, and appreciate the time to talk about this.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Christopher. This is great.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Okay, we're going to leave it there for today. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as thanks to our engineer, Jeet Paul. Amazing, amazing engineer who makes this all happen. Show music is by the very talented Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage's website or as a podcast, wherever you may find your podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you want to hear more of, maybe less of. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.